I gotta get rid of my intro song. I've said this like a million times. I actually need Austin, you to rejigger this. Good Shows was good. It put like a positive feel, you know, Benny? Like,
yeah, well, yeah, Freeze Me, Death From Above, of course, yeah.
Yeah,
and you know what? It's such a good song that there was, a couple year period there where I couldn't listen to it because the idea of doing the show was a bad thing, but it's like your alarm going off. Like the hairs on the back of my neck would stand up straight when I heard that song. But now that I have separation from Good Show, I'm back into listening to that song. It is so good. My kids love that song. Such a good song. Yeah, and it
I
was
do
pumping.
Like that
we
your
got,
kids
get you ready for
it.
The show.
See, I actually this brings me into a topic that I wanted to start the show with today, which is about fan consideration. I brought this up earlier this week, and it's counter to everything that I've ever felt as a sports fan. But I don't like that you play that song in your house and like your boys like it, and they know it just as a song, like not as your Good Show theme song. You know that?
No, they know it.
Feelings.
They're like, this is your work song. Play your work song again.
They
is
say
what
that.
They say.
They better say that. They better say that. Okay, that makes me feel better. That makes me feel a little bit better because otherwise I would have gotten a little tiny bit upset. Because this is what. I don't know how much this says about me or if this is a real thing. You're a Schadenfreude guy. We've talked about this a lot.
Yeah. Not proud of it.
Yeah, I know you're not proud of it, but you are. It's just a fact. You are that. just be who you are.
Yeah.
Kevin O'Connor yesterday puts out a column about the Clippers being interested in Fred VanVleet. Mm-hmm. And Kyle Lowry, too. The Kyle Lowry thing is he's actually so washed up that it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he goes to the Clippers. In fact, good on him. In a weird way, I wouldn't mind that one. But I really don't want the Clippers to win a championship with Kawhi Leonard. I've been on this block for a while, and now the Clippers are turning it around, right? They just beat the Lakers yesterday 10 straight times. They're cooking. Kawhi looks amazing. He looks genuinely exactly like the Kawhi that won a championship here in Toronto. This was in reference to the Canucks considering trading Bo Horvat to Vancouver, and I was talking about this with Jackie Redmond, actually, last week. Should fan consideration be a part of the way front offices do business? Like, if you're trading Bo Horvat to Boston, and you don't get and you're not getting back like a life-changing package, should fans matter? Should it matter to a front office, like, boy, if Bo lifts a cup and it's our captain, and he's wearing the colors of the team that beat us in a Stanley Cup final, how is this going to resonate with fans? Is this going to turn people off? How angry is this going to make people? Do you think that the Fred and Kawhi thing kind of fits that category? And if so, should a front office consider it? Like, do you need an added price to make deals like that get done?
I think you do. I think the Clippers one is a little different. But like as far as the Canucks and Bruins one, I absolutely do think that that should play a factor. Unless you're, unless it's so obvious, unless the calculus is just like so overwhelming, but
that's
Bo Horvat's going to have a lot of suitors, right?
Like, yes, that's it.
So
it's
what?
Like, pick one of the other ones. It's like hockey. How could you possibly, this was exactly my point. You'd have to come over the top with multiple extra first round picks. But I kind of feel the same way with Fred. Like, you can't find a different place for him to go. It has to be the Clippers. You really like Terrence Mann that much? Who's like 27 years old? He's one of those old prospects. You remember how with Chris Boucher we did this for a while where we went, hey, this guy is not a prospect. He's 100. Then people went, no, he's young. He's a prospect. Terrence Mann is sort of like that too from the Clippers. Anyway, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that, your number one priority as an executive should be to win a championship. But that's super hard, right? And, like, one move, unless it is a Kawhi Leonard for DeMar DeRozan, one move is probably not going to put you there. So there is something to placating your fan base sounds bad. But, like, ingratiating yourself to your fan base because, well, it's the owner that's making the calls. Owners are influenced by fan behavior. We know this. We've heard it time and time again, and we've also just seen the proof in the pudding multiple times that when you start feeling a fan base turn on a front office, it's really hard to turn it the other way. And you know what turns a fan base against front office is sending an all-time franchise player to a franchise that had like spies in the building your entire championship season trying to woo the guy who was only there for 1 year. And we like saw Lawrence Frank and it, like he, I mean, the amount of money he spent on season tickets for Raptors home games in 2019 is outrageous. Yeah, that would not feel great. Not that, you know, Masai Ujiri, Bobby Webster could ever not ingratiate themselves to the Raptors fan base, but that should factor in. Don't like, I don't think the Raptors trading away Fred VanVleet, as great as he has been and as all-star caliber as he has been in the past and maybe returning to that form recently, this move, like you mentioned, Terrence Mann and like the no draft picks that come back from the Clippers because they have none, or like
they're like future. Remember, I used to have that joke about the Terminator movie.
2028.
In the future, because they could always make a sequel. Yeah, they beat that Terminator, but in the future, now the Terminator. They go, oh, just let the Terminator kill us then. This is a never-ending loop. Why do we keep coming back for more? This is awful. We keep having to do this. That's basically the Clippers picks is well beyond when the chatbots have taken over Earth and we just have nothing left.
The kid who's drafted in the first round in 2028 is now 13. Dude.
This is actually the perfect intersection of our interests. Is should you be avoiding future first round picks that far away, considering how rapidly AI is developing, that maybe it's not.
We should ask AI if it's worth hanging around for 2028.
Dude, how soon till AI can determine trades? Because we already have these things, right?
Yeah.
I hate it. The baseball nerds love to use those things, right? Those calculators where they go, the Jays won this trade. And you go, okay, that's so you say. All right, we'll see. Because I saw that with the Gabriel Moreno trade where they got Dalton Varsho. And there's, have you seen that Twitter account? No, there's a, it's like
about?
Baseball trade grade or some math trade math.
Okay.
Somebody's got it. I'm surprised you don't know about it.
That's kind of... they just add the war, probably, right?
No, I don't know. It's I think it's a bit more... It's a little more complicated than that, okay?
Sure it is, buddy.
It's a little more complicated than that. But it's a website where they determine
you're
how...
You're more of a sports nerd than me. Like, I don't know. Some of the texts that you're sending me about sports, you're, like, more into the numbers than me. Like, how's it become that I'm, like, Mr. Like, let's see it play out
because
on
I'm
the
getting
field.
Ready for the age of machines where everything is going to be quantified by numbers. I'm getting ready to embrace our overlords. We used to talk about Rocco's Basilisk. And it's either you're for or against the machines. You're either helping or you're against them. I'm for. I'm here, machines. Woo-hoo. Let go, machines. You're going to do it. So jump on board the numbers train. No, for real. That actually might become a thing where you just go, hey, ChatGPT, should we trade Fred VanVleet for Terrence Mann in a first-round pick?
Why isn't it? How come we haven't done this now? Well, I mean, the thing is they don't have updated stats. So
And they can't hey, technology can't have... We should be... You know what? You're right. Hey, nerds, you guys got to get off your block because the computers can do it so much better than you and the technology is going to happen so fast that
Blake,
you
throw
are
out
gonna...
the spreadsheets.
Dude, Blake is in trouble. You know who's going to live like kings? You and I. Feel guys. I test guys. The things that are not quantifiable. No, well, that's it. That's the only thing left. The only thing left in the post AI world is going to be the unquantifiable, right? The things that the machine can't feel.
ChatGPT, how much heart does Fred VanVleet have? Undefined amount of heart.
He has 6 grams of heart. that's it. That's all ChatGPT can do. Anyway, this is great. I'm sorry to all the listeners that have no idea what we're talking about with ChatGPT and with chatbots in general.
Look it up.
And artificial intelligence. Yeah. And actually, you should look it up. Actually, don't, because you'll be afraid and it might ruin your day. But yeah, if you want your day ruined, then just go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, I think it should matter. And I think that the Clippers, if they were to win a championship, especially this season where the NBA is so wide open, and we had to watch a summer of Fred VanVleet, Kawhi, and Norm Powell all celebrating that together, that would sting, man. That would really sting. And I just don't see a Clippers price that you're getting back. If there was a thing, right? If there was a Clippers player or prospect or draft pick that I thought was really overwhelmingly awesome, then I would be okay with that. You'd have to roll the dice. But this is one where Yeah, I just don't see it. I don't see it. I advocate against. If I'm in the room with Masai Ujiri, I'm going, does the 2028 future first round pick, sure, it could be great, but the 3 years of championship memorabilia for the Clippers before we land up in a draft we don't really know about, it just, we can't do it.
No, that one makes little to no sense. Plus, I would imagine, and not that the Raptors can't turn around and flip that pick in the offseason, but it's such a weird pivot point for this franchise, because I mean, especially if you're holding on to Pascal Siakam, which I imagine you are, and it's possible that they're holding on to OG Anunoby, but they're clearly holding on to Scottie Barnes, that you're not going to do like a, yeah, this is like a pivot. They're going to try and be back in the playoff picture in 2023-24 in the NBA's Eastern Conference. So, yeah, how is a pick in 2028 helping you accomplish that? Like, you do need, like, rotation players. Because, yeah, it's not like you're gonna free up cap space. You can't. Like, there's no feasible way to do that if you trade everybody away and get nothing but expiring contracts.
Yeah, no, that's true. And if they did that with Clippers, it would be something like Robert Covington and Terrence Mann. Marks had a fake trade that was Clippers-related that had those guys in it. And that's basically the way that you get the math done and you get some decent players and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Shy just texted me and said that there's a site. So Shy and I, basically the same baseball guy.
Yeah, nerds. Yeah, big nerds.
Yeah, yeah, big, huge nerds. Okay, can I give you a hot take then, too, that I have about this?
Nah.
Well, the one of the main reasons that I had you on today was we wanted to kind of flesh out this idea about being a sports fan of a good team, not a great team, but a team that's already had its rise and you've seen it peak, kind of like where the Raptors are right now. I would argue that they're not a good team either, even though they can show signs of it every once
they're
in a while.
Like,
yeah, of course.
No, they're awful. Like, defensively, there's no metric that you can show me that tells me they're like good in transition offense and defense.
Yeah.
That's it. That's literally it. And like half-court offense, abysmal. Defense across the board, abysmal. They're horrible.
Well, it's especially funny because they were built on defense. That was the whole thing. They were going to be this undeniably great defensive team, and they were figuring out the offense on the fly, and they can't even do that. So you go, all right, this is clearly, to me, I've said it, I'm in tear it down territory with the Raptors. Like, if they went into the offseason, they traded Pascal Siakam, and they traded OG Anunoby at this deadline for a massive haul of picks and players, I would be fine with it, given that Scottie Barnes has taken a real step forward, and they just don't have enough around him. Anyway, the premise of today was kind of being, hey, when you're a fan of a good sports team, but you know there isn't that next thing coming for them, or there isn't a superstar player that you're going to build around, you're kind of in a spot where the Raptors were at the end of their run, right, with DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, where you know what the ceiling is, and that's not being a championship team, but you're good, and you win a bunch of games every single year, and you're kind of waiting for this idea of developing. Is that, like, I guess the worst thing as a sports fan is to be a fan of a team with high expectations that falls apart, right? That's the worst, where you're just frustrated every night. But is that a enjoyable experience anymore for you?
Well,
is that an enjoyable experience for most sports fans who are adults? Like, kids, yes. Kid, you take to a basketball game, they just want to see the team win. And I get that that's a huge part of what this is and what this is supposed to be. But just for, like, an adult sports fan now in 2023 with all the information that we have, is being a good team in any sport with a ceiling of not winning and not on the rise fun?
It's so sport-dependent, right? Because if you get into the playoffs in the NHL or Major League Baseball, you have a chance to win a championship. So as long as you're a playoff team, that's really all that matters. I will say in the NBA, yeah, it felt like we were locked in this prison of, like, mediocrity with the DeMar DeRozan, Kyle Lowry Raptors until we saw that the formula was actually to be kind of that good and then wait for your moment to strike for the superstar caliber player that puts you over the top and you win a championship. Maybe to never happen again, but we did see the formula there. I gotta say, like, I was pretty excited about this Raptors season going into this year, considering the way they played the second half of last year and the way they almost came all the way back in that first round series against the Sixers with a banged up Scottie Barnes. I was like, another step forward for Scottie Barnes. Is like, this is this team, well, they were an upper half, almost an upper half of the playoff bracket in the Eastern Conference team last year. Why couldn't they take a step forward this year? So it's kind of hard for me to apply that logic to the 2022-23 Raptors. I think what we want as sports fans, though, is, like, variety. Like, if you're the same, that's what's so infuriating about the Leafs, right? It's just like, it's Groundhog Day year after year after year. now that we've seen good regular season after good regular season, which basically only started in the All-Canadian division. That was the first time they really dominated a regular season, because the narrative going into that year was that we need to see it over the course of not 82 games, however many they played that
they
year.
They set records, though, in 2019 for regular season. They did. They set franchise records. And I know it's weird.
Great.
But I'm just, yeah, anyway, whatever.
Yeah, that was not a dominant regular season team, right?
Like, no, they were actually considering selling at the deadline. No kidding.
We did a trade deadline show where we were like, yeah, Tyson Berry, any takers? And they're like, no. Yeah. I'm like, okay. And then,
I'll give you a franchise center for him. For 1 year. For 1 year of him. Please, we'll do anything.
Yeah, massive upset losing to the Columbus Blue Jackets, who I think when the shutdown happened were like 1 point back at the Leafs. They were basically coin flip. And yeah, it went five games in that weirdo season that we'd all like to forget. But yeah, no, that's the worst thing is like Groundhog Day, year over year over year, feeling like there's no escape from it. And the Raptors were turning into that. With DeMar DeRozan and Fred VanVleet, we thought like that was the end of it, because you saw a LeBron James Cavs team that was the worst of a generation, and other teams were able to give them a run for their money, and still the Raptors got swept by it. But then they immediately trade for Kawhi Leonard and win a championship. But that's the worst thing, is the repetitive nature of seasons where you feel like there's no escape.
Okay, I'm so glad that you went to this, because this is going to lead me into something else a little bit later. I agree with you about the variety. I've talked about this many times, about how this is an entertainment product, but it's weird because the goal of it is to win championships, and a lot of times continuity breeds that, and smart general managers usually like stick with a plan, right? They tweak their plans, but they don't just abandon them like fans do, where one night they go, this team sucks, and then the next night they go, this team's really good. This team's really, really good. I think these guys got shot. That's basically Raptors and Leaf fans right now all the time, right? And it happens with the Jays a lot too. But I kind of get this feeling right now that all the Toronto teams are sort of in that bracket I'm talking about, where, and I know, this is just my opinion, okay? You could say nah, but my opinion is that all the Toronto teams right now are just kind of good, but none of them are great. And yeah, could the Blue Jays win if they get in and everything goes perfect for them? Yeah, it could happen, but I'm not looking at the opening day roster right now and going, boy, these guys, like, this is just...
Yankees are starting Aaron Hicks in left field, and Josh Donaldson's the third baseman again.
It's so funny that you keep doing this with the Yankees, because this has been your move. Like, this is your dice move for the last, like, 7 years, is the Yankees suck, and they keep finishing better than the Jays, and you keep going, double down. You're just sitting there broke. How long are you allowed to do this? How long are you allowed to continuously double down on this? Okay, yeah.
Playing
either way,
the
Jays are good. I just don't think the Jays are great. I think the Leafs are good. I think that things could break their way where they get to a cup final, but I don't feel that's the case this year. I don't. The goaltending has been really good with Samsonov at home this season, but do I really trust Samsonov and Matt Murray? Do I really believe that this team is going to go to a Stanley Cup final and win? I don't know. I don't get that feel all the time. I watch the Bruins, I go, that's a great team. I don't feel that way watching the Leafs. The Raptors, same thing. They're not a good team, but they have good pieces. And I kind of go, okay, eventually. But this is what I'm saying. The Raptors are actually the most interesting team to me out of this entire group, because they have all this variety of different directions that they could end up going. There's these arguments that they're better than they are. They're worse than they are. They could trade Fred VanVleet. They could trade OG Anunoby. They could trade Pascal Siakam. And you just said it, that variety, right? That's the fun thing as a sports fan. But I said it, good general managers, they don't do that. And I think Toronto has three really smart front offices who all have three really concrete plans. And my take is, having a good front office sucks because it's no fun. Have a wild card shooter in there. Look at Oklahoma City. Everyone loves Sam Presti, right? All he's doing is hoarding picks forever and ever and ever. He can't make a trade. He's paralyzed by the fact that he can't take a step back in any of these deals, right? He can't lose in that ChatGPT thing that Shai just sent me, the trade machine. Masai Ujiri, similar way. My biggest fear with the Raptors heading into the deadline is that, like, Grange put it out there the other day on the Raptors show about how, hey, they haven't 100% walked themselves off of bringing back Gary Trent Jr. or something along those lines. They're like, they're not committed to moving, or 100% committed to moving him. I hate when I misquote insiders because I know how much it bothers them. So go to Michael Grange's Twitter to see exactly what it is. Don't tell him I sent you there with wrong information. But my biggest fear is that Masai, being such a, like, principled, smart general manager, president, that he and Bobby Webster are not going to make a trade where it's like, oh, we kind of lost that trade a little bit, but it was the thing we needed to do. Look what how they held firm on Kyle Lowry. Look how
that's what I was going to bring up. Yeah,
dude, Kyle Dubas.
They're not going to be forced into a move here, right? Even though it's pretty clear that this team stinks.
Yeah.
Because yeah, the return that they're going to get on Gary Trent Jr. or Fred VanVleet, considering they have to bring players back, is not going to be overwhelming. It's going to be something, as opposed to the nothing when they opt out of their contracts at the end of the year and the Raptors decide that it's not financially responsible to re-sign those guys. But those are not franchise-altering trades that we're about to see in a month's time.
Bingo. And look at the Maple Leafs. Everybody thinks Kyle Dubas is super aggressive because they haven't had these first-round picks, but one of the picks had to get traded to get off the Marleau contract, right?
Yeah.
One of the first-round picks was in the North Division for Nick Foligno, and it didn't work out, and then everyone freaked out saying it was a dumb move. Even the, like, hardcore Kyle Dubasites, that was the one time where they sort of turned on him and went, this wasn't good, even though the Dumbos, the feels, the guys who are going to have radio shows and podcasts in the future because they go off of feel and heart and intangibles and things you can't quantify. We liked it. But if you look at his history recently, it's been pretty non-aggressive. Last year they went out and got Mark Giordano. That was great, but it was a second-round pick. But look at what Tampa did. They went out and said, first-round picks, and we're going to get Brandon Hagel, and we're going to make sure that we get Nick Paul. Look at what Boston did. They went out and made sure they got Hampus Lindholm. They went and moved real assets to get these guys. This isn't Dubas' sweet spot. He doesn't love the deadline. You know why? Because he's a smart guy who understands that this is when dumb deals get made. And I think that this is less fun. All I'm saying is it's probably the best thing, right? But this is less fun having kind of general managers and presidents with big teams who won't lose on trades.
At a certain point, though, you get pushed to your limit and you see the end being nigh, by which I mean like the end of your contract and potentially the end of your tenure with the glamour franchise in the National Hockey League. And even Alex Anthopoulos, he's a smart guy. We thought his move for all the Marlins players in 2013 was super smart. But at a certain point, you just throw caution to the wind like he did at the trade deadline in 2015. Because, like, this team is good. We have, like, a positive run differential and we're 500. Yeah. So what the hell? Let's throw it all at the wall and see what sticks. Because if it fails, I'm fired anyways. Like, who would fault Kyle Dubas for doing that? Like, and maybe that's not the smart move.
But maybe. I can't tell if this is the dumbest thing we've ever done or the smartest thing we've ever done, which is actually when I love our segments the most.
Yeah.
Maybe the market inefficiency is having that general manager / president, whatever, that isn't afraid to take those losses to do something that's a little unconventional or crazy. That's what I'm saying. It's like everyone's so smart and everyone has the ChatGPT bots that are judging these trades and telling you exactly whether or not that hold on. I'm going to look at the Shy Text and get this actually right because he sent me the name of the place. Baseball Trade Values is the site. He says they compare dollar values of different players. Blah, blah, blah. Right. Who cares? It's the worst. Like, the idea that anyone would read that is just you're a criminal. Like, go to jail immediately. You go to Moon Jail. Like, that's what you want in your sports is, well, MLB trade value chart said the money. Like, boo. Yeah. That's
who
horrible.
Who cares if Kyle Dubas, loses every trade at the deadline as long as they get players that help, like, and they re-sign nobody. Like, who cares if it's nothing but rental players? I don't know if this is a straw man or not. I wouldn't care, right? Like, it would feel like a self-serving move, and I don't know. I guess the theoretical conversation is, would Brendan Shanahan, would the board, like, allow him to make reckless moves at the deadline seemingly
the
to
board.
Save his skin? Yeah, whoever's in charge, you know,
I
the
picture
League of Kyle Shadows.
Dubas walking up with his, like, shaky papers to the, like, the 20 guys in suits with, like, dim lighting on their faces and just shaking.
Yeah, exactly.
The trade chart value has determined shake. It's like,
go nuts, table. Man. Have your Alex Anthopoulos 2015. Why not? Mm. Right? Like, at this point, This core.
But that worked. That's what I'm saying. Everybody, he got criticized by the smart nerds that are now this front office. They went, you gave up too much. But that's actually the most successful the Jays have ever been. 100%. And that's the only team that I've ever looked at.
Deadline.
Dude, this is that Blue Jays team when I was talking about, hey, this team feels good, not great to me. And they could have a deadline like that. Maybe they do load up, although seems like they have zero left in the farm system now, actually, which is the ironic part of this, is that there's really nothing the Blue Jays have to offer to anyone. That was the greatest team. And it was because a guy was just gunslinging and went, we'll do that. Like, we'll go.
Yeah.
You want to see me get nuts? I'll get nuts.
Well, and not only was he going to be fired from the Blue Jays, like, it's quite possible that Alex Anthopoulos, if those moves don't pay off, is like, I mean, he's working in a front office, I suppose, but, and he went to go hide out with the Dodgers for a bit, but knew his chance would arrive again, as a general manager, and he landed in a perfect spot in Atlanta. But, like, his career as a general manager is in serious jeopardy if he's reckless there and the Jays continue to flounder and miss the playoffs yet again for a 20-whatever time in a row. But yeah, no, Kyle Dubas, get nuts here. What's that?
I know we do hindsight with so many of these things, right, where we go, this is what happened there. But I never felt in 2015, and granted, I'm dumb as a baseball guy now. I was even dumber then, right? Like, but I never felt in the moment any of the moves that they made at the 2015 deadline were incredibly reckless.
Well, I mean, the biggest one was the Tulo deal. Yeah,
that was the riskiest.
They gave up prospects that we had heard of at least, right? Like there were guys that were high picks that were at the top of the food chain when it came to prospects, which doesn't always happen. And yeah, they got the guys at the very top of the market. That's it. I mean, so yeah, they must have paid a higher price than anybody else was willing to pay, right? They went out and got David Price at the last possible second. They went out and jumped the market on Troy Tulowitzki, who maybe people didn't realize was totally available. But no,
I'm just saying it was Jeff Hoffman was the name of the guy, right? That went out the door
right,
for Tulo.
The guy that they were going to trade for a general manager like a season prior.
Yeah. Oh, God, that would have been something had they done that. The Orioles guy.
Yeah.
That's dark.
No, it was definitely a roll of the dice. And of course, yes, famously, everybody understands that none of those guys came back to haunt the Blue Jays. But at the time, no, man, they leveraged lots of future assets. Yeah. They didn't totally strip the minor league system bare, but those were some highly touted guys that were expected to contribute at the major league level, and they said, see you later. We're going to try and make the playoffs, and it worked out swimmingly, of course.
Leafs and Blue Jays also in a similar spot in terms of they both have just one prospect, and all of the organizational hopes are on one prospect's shoulders. Matthew Nyes is supposed to bring secondary scoring and toughness and cheap contract to the Blue Jays, and Ricky Tiedemann is the next. Yes.
Get him out of here.
I know, but I'm just saying, both of those guys, this is also something I was talking about is that with Frank Cervelli yesterday, how, yeah, of course Tiedemann, and although Tiedemann I think is like top 30 in prospect ranks, like both these guys are good prospects, right? Obviously, Tiedemann and Nyes, they're valued, but they get overvalued by their fan bases because if you take those guys away, it's like, wow. You got Nick Robertson and Relvis Martinez. That's what you got at the top. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Let's come back, and then I want to do a rapid fire of like 20 different topics with you for the rest of Good Hour. Subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars, do all those nice things. Ben Ennis, Good Hour continues after a quick break.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So, you watched Banshees of Inisherin yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really great movie. I told you. Awesome. I'm sorry to air my dirty laundry this way and throw my mom under the bus because she listens to a lot of these shows. But she, like, I loved that movie, but she kind of half ruined it for me because she wouldn't shut up during the movie. She just kept bringing up stats, like different things she knows about Ireland for the entire time. And like some of it was like, okay, because she's been to Ireland many times and, you know, we've got Irish family back. Way back, and she's obsessed with that. But it would just be like randomly, she'd be like, "The Celtic Cross is my favorite one," and I'd be like, "Great, like, keep it moving." Like, I'm trying to watch a movie.
did you watch it with the captions on? Because I did.
No,
because
no, I
yeah,
I well, have a like refined
even,
palate.
Even when
for
people
listening.
Aren't you know speaking in very hard to decipher Irish accents, like I'm so old that my hearing isn't the best, so I watch a lot of shows with the captions on, but like I don't think I could have gotten through that movie without the captions.
Did you turn the captions on though, or does your wife have the captions on permanently? Because I find that when I'm in relationships, all my streaming services, everything is on, all the captions are on, because a lot of the ladies, like ex-girlfriends, they've always had like captions on. That's a real
No doubt. Yeah, there is an element to that, but and quite often I will turn them off, and I'll be like, let's just try it. Let's just try it without the captions, and then
now
we'll put them back on.
But now she's ruined you, is what you're saying. You can't do it anymore. You're out.
Well, I knew going into that movie that it would probably be, like, best for me, because I don't know.
That's fine, though, a foreign movie like that where there's heavy accents. Not me, though. Again, I have Irish blood, so it's just easy for me. I'm basically those guys, you know, except a little bit cooler. Took all the cool parts. Yeah, you got it.
Feasible, not in this country.
Yeah, but that's my guy, beer guy. You saw that clip, right? You saw that?
What's that?
You saw that, beer guy? The clip, the dude talking about the...
outside of the LCBO about the drinking beers. You can only have maybe get away with 2 drinks a week, but like even that, you're basically putting a loaded gun up to your head if you do that.
I was gonna say that a lot of people I know are in big trouble. That report came down. Do you remember how there was that report out of California, like, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, where they said, hey, if you sleep with your cell phone beside your bed, you're gone.
Oh, yeah.
And then we just ignored it. Everyone decided collectively, hey, we all do this, so we can't be having this around. This has got to go immediately. This is done. We're burying this report. I think that the same thing has to happen with what we did here with the booze report, where it came from like a credible place. And I was like, yeah, no thanks. Let's get this out of here. Okay, so yesterday I went... I visited my grandmother out in Trenton, and I just jumped on a Via, just hustled down there. It was great. Two quick things from it. One is cabs in small towns versus you really take in the perspective of how different Uber and a cab is in a big city, and the type of vehicle that you're getting into here versus going to a small town. Like, I went to Owen Sound to visit Sammy and do his wedding there this summer, and just like, if you go to a small town, you're getting into an old van and the guy's listening to conservative talk radio. That's what you get there.
That is a move for anyone in a rideshare or a cab to be listening to talk radio of any sort.
It would never happen here. I've never had that. Dude, you know, I get into a million Ubers here. Never once have I ever listened to talk radio before. It's purely music. Music or silence. Or the driver talking on his phone to someone in, like, not English. Like, almost every single time. But small town? Horrible beater that you're like, boy, this car is on its last legs. Conservative
the shocks
talk radio.
Are like out of control. Like, the car is bouncing up and down.
Yeah, 100%. Van that you kind of like, the door is sticky and you're like, boy, this is going to be my last ride. then conservative talk radio. But the other thing, so I'm on the train. I get on. And this is a lovely lady. You know, she was actually, she was like a deputy mayor. And she... had a lot to say. Anyway, I get into the train, I sit down in my seat, and she immediately goes, oh, what are the odds? I'm actually right beside you. Oh, that's great. Now we have a talking point. She talked to me the entire ride. I really wanted to take a nap on the train. I really wanted to get a little bit of work done. You know, do a little bit of interview prep on the train. This is why I took, like, this is like, I love the train. It's like, you can have a nap, and you can read a bit of a book, you can listen to a little bit of a podcast, and you can get a little bit of work done. We talked the entire time, and I don't have the... I don't have the gene to not talk to, like, a little old lady. Like, if it was some guy who's my age.
I was going to say, like, did you start giving shorter and shorter responses? Because that's a way to peter it out and, like, give the subtle indication without saying, hey, lady, shut up for a second.
The worst part is, like, we had outs where there was uncomfortable silences and I just had to push through them for, like, a second. You know, like, I just had to push through them and be like, I'm going to listen to my music and do that. And instead I'd be like, 3, 2. So, how old is your grandkid? And I couldn't help it because I knew she wanted to talk. And she had even made a note about young people looking at their phones and always being distracted. And then I took that kind of personally. She sucked me in for an hour and 45-minute conversation about so many things. And then she even started to talk to me about, like, healthcare. And I went, no, please, I don't really want to.
Oh,
and,
God.
Yeah, it was tough. And I don't know how to, like, is this me or is this an actual thing? Was there a way for me to do this that was actually good?
Well, like you said, well, you saw it. You know what it is. It was
But that was rude to her. That was rude. Because, again, people from our generation, I don't think it's rude to just say, hey, like, I'm going to listen to my music, right? Mm-hmm. She even had a conversation with me that I thought was actually pretty insightful about how a lot of people now write at the top of emails, hey, right? But to her, reading hey at the beginning of an email is kind of like, whoa, what the hell is this? They're from the letter writing generation where it's like, good morning, right, or dear, you know? And I went, huh, you know, like I actually enjoyed that that insight. So I think that being just like, hey, I'm going to listen to my music instead of talk to you is actually like a...
How about this? Hey, I know this is a foreign concept for you, but like how about like honesty? Like how about just saying, really...
I'm overly honest.
I've enjoyed our conversation a lot, but I really thought I would take some of the time on the train to do some work. If you wouldn't mind, I'm just gonna like turn over here and do some prep
work. And I open up a document and go like, are sports better with thumb GMs? And she looks at me and goes, that's what you do, huh?
Yeah.
And I go, yeah. I look at her. Dumb good, smart bad.
Dude,
that's what I'm doing here. Yeah.
You just reminded me, I took some pictures of this and I never shared them with the world because I think it would put my marriage in jeopardy. But we just took a Mexican vacation a couple of weeks ago. And with our two children, we were on a plane where the seats worked. There was three and three, right? So my wife and the two kids were on, they had their whole section to themselves, and I was across the aisle in seat number one of the other section. My wife is a take your shoes off on the airplane person with no socks. Like,
oh my God.
was barefoot on the plane, but like not next to people she didn't know. She was next to two children, but even still, I was flabbergasted. I was appalled. I just said, you're a no shoes person, eh? She's like, yeah, I don't know. We're next to our kids, like as if it was nothing. Yeah, and like I think she's working now and she's not listening, at least I fingers crossed. But yeah, no, she is. She's a no shoes, no socks person on an airplane. I'm sure she wouldn't have done it if she was sitting next to somebody she didn't, you know, if she was in my seat.
Bare feet.
Yeah.
No socks. Yeah.
Oh, I have the pictures on my phone. I'll send them to you.
No, not a sock in sight.
Oh, my.
No.
It was a scene, man.
No, that's so wrong. That's wrong. That's not a good thing. I don't think you should wear shorts on a plane. Like, I'm that against skin.
I grew up in a household in which you, like, got dressed up to go on an airplane. And part of that was because we were flying standby and with my dad, who was a pilot at the time. And we all hoped to get, like, bumped up to first class. So, you know, try to class it up a little bit. But, yeah.
I like dressing up. And I don't mean dressing up in terms of get a suit on because that's crazy. But, I mean, I like wearing a nice jumpsuit.
Collared
and,
shirt.
You know,
yeah.
No. Like, I like wearing a fit to the plane, to the airport. It feels good. And you're comfortable, whatever. You look good. It's better. But yeah, you should have said something more aggressive to her and told her to put her damn shoes on. That's like, you'd be like, you're my wife. How about just put your shoes on, please, for the love of God. Anyway, I knew you weren't the right person to talk to about this though, because you would never have this interaction because you always have kids. And so it's like the kids are always there as, hey, I don't have time for your chit chat. I've got these urgent things that need my constant attention. So yeah, you're not the guy to converse about with this. I'm sorry. It's just it's not a thing.
And yeah, okay. I love to let conversations peter out.
Yeah, like this one right now. Okay, so outfield dimensions. You were extremely wrong. You could not have been more wrong.
Wait a second.
Yeah, no.
In what way?
In the history of being wrong, there's a picture of you, you know, like all the different people that were just unbelievably off.
You mean because the right
you were
center
like
field.
They are going to design this defensive outfield and that's what makes sense because they have a defensive outfield now and they made a bandbox joke park. Like, I gotta tell you, it's actually kind of such a joke park that I'm a little turned off. The dimensions are pretty bad, man. That power alley is basically like
20 feet shorter, like 20 feet. That is
20 feet.
No joke. I mean, it's 18, I think. And we don't know how high the wall will be in right center field, but that's 20 feet is an enormous number to subtract from any wall anywhere. And it's straight away is going to be the same, right? To the corners is going to be the exact same. It's the power alleys, but specifically in right center field. And it is noteworthy that the Blue Jays did definitely diversify the offense in acquiring three left-handed bats. I mean, Kevin Kiermaier is a bat. But yeah,
well, I was just going to say, this is going to be hilarious now when Kevin Kiermaier and Dalton Varsho hit a bunch of home runs over that little.
Well,
you know,
Dalton Varsho does hit a bunch of home runs, right? Hit 27 a year ago.
I'm just saying that both of those guys, you're going to be able to look at their numbers now and you're going to be able to say, hey, they actually, like, these were really astute moves based on the number of home runs these guys ended up hitting into that power.
Well, shouldn't you want to get players that are well suited to your ballpark? And the Blue Jays, I guess the company line here is that this ballpark will still play neutral, because despite what just about everybody says or experiences in that ballpark and in feeling like a hitter's ballpark in past iterations, it has played pretty neutral, not favoring the pitchers or the hitters. It's really hard for me to imagine, even if the wall is 30 feet high in right center field, those are still doubles off the wall, right? Like, that's still a hit. It's not an out. Whereas, like, last year, if you had 20 more feet of room for the right fielder, it would have been an out. Those outs of the wall are either home runs or doubles this season. That alone, I just, it's hard for me to imagine it not playing like an absolute bandbox next season.
Buddy, it has also made me feel even stronger about my they should have never traded Teoscar take. Like, what's the point of even having a right fielder with any defense? Like, what are they going to do out there? What's the right fielder the Blue Jays doing?
I guess the argument is that it's like an irregular shaped outfield, that it's really going to take some smarts to figure out how to play the outfield. It is, just by matter of fact, going to be a smaller outfield. Listen, we talked about this, I think, last time I was on, that this team is way better with Teoscar Hernandez still on it. No offense to Eric Swanson. Like, Teoscar Hernandez.
Oh, offense to Eric Swanson on me. It's like, it's not your fault, but there is absolutely no reality in which Eric Swanson helps your baseball team more than Teoscar Hernandez in a must-win
season. And especially, it's going to favor left-handed hitters that pull the ball, but also right-handed hitters who use all parts of the ballpark, which Vlad does, which Bo Bichette does, which Teoscar Hernandez is capable of as well. Like, this is a guy that's already been a silver slugger in Major League Baseball. It's hard to imagine it not being a hitter's paradise.
Dude, it's going to be. All these guys' numbers.
For anybody that hits it to right field.
Yeah, all these guys, this is going to be an incredible season for, like, this is going to now match 2015, where you're going to say the offense is spectacular because everybody is going to be able to, you're right, the doubles off that wall, regardless of how high it is, or the home runs in that power alley are going to get ridiculous. I know that you and I are different kind of baseball fans, though. I do wonder if, like, do you think, this is another stupid question, I talk about smart offices, but I was wondering this too. Are we in the era with baseball where home runs have kind of peaked in terms of, like, fan interest in them being, that's the thing you want to see at the ballpark? I know we have these, like, weird studies that are like, no, people like triples and doubles more than they like home runs now. But yeah, if you go to a ballpark now and you go to a bunch of Blue Jays games, and this does become so hitter friendly that we get to the point where home runs over that area of the field, we go, do you think it's actually, like, do you think it's good for the product still, for the average fan?
I don't think any Yankee fans were, like, upset that Aaron Judge hit all his home runs last year. Like, I think, and a lot of them were to the joke part of that ballpark. That's a even jokier ballpark, because that is, like, straightaway right field. No, I think home run is still something people enjoy watching. I do think people hate strikeouts, and fingers crossed we see fewer of them this season, although the rules have, you know, allowed for ground balls through the right side to become hits and not necessarily.
See, that's what I'm most excited for about next year, is the banning of the shift. And people have said that it won't be as drastic as in my mind I think about it, where everyone's, like, stapled to their base. But I'm more curious to see that. I guess where I'm at with the home run thing is, you're right, I'm being stupid, I'm overthinking this to a degree, but I love seeing a home run. Who doesn't? When a guy actually connects and just rips a ball into the second deck and you go, holy crap, like that's a towering home run. He really got that. But I would say that there is a feeling of cheapness to me when a guy has what feels like just like a fly out and then it squeaks over the fence and you go, oh, right. Yeah, I don't know. I think that even
I can't wait for that take when Dalton Varsho is like hitting a bottom of the ninth walk-off three-run home run against the Yankees. Man, this
gets to use that fence too.
Of course. Everybody, yes, that's the thing. It's not unfair because everybody plays at the same ballpark. But yeah, when you know that your ballpark is going to favor left-handers that pull the ball, and you go out that offseason and get two notable left-handers that pull the ball, I think it would favor you more than other teams, or at least you would hope that it would.
Yeah,
I'm sure that went into the thinking. Blue Jays needed to get more diverse offensively, anyways, this past offseason. But man, it had to be at least like a 1% part of the thought process this offseason.
Completely agree. In fact, my biggest thought off of it after I went, ooh, this is kind of again different strokes for different folks. But from a more, I'm never going to call myself a baseball purist. That's way too strong. But, yeah, I don't know. From someone who watches every single baseball game of the summer for the Blue Jays, I was not thrilled at the idea of that being 20 feet in. That was just too much. I went, this is going to feel a little bit like the opposite of what the Orioles did, where like you tinkered too much, right? You tinkered too much with your ballpark. It feels like a little – maybe I'm just adverse to change. Maybe I'll see it and I'll love it. I already like a lot of the concourse designs. I've already been a fan of the way that the bullpen's going to be. Like, there's some cool stuff that's coming. I thought that that particular element of it was a bit too far. But my second thought was, Brandon Belt's going to play more than we think if he's healthy.
100%. And there's only one position for him, right? It's first base DH. Like, I know this is a guy that years ago has played a corner outfield spot. He's a broken man at this point. No, he's either DH or first base, which is, that's going to be an interesting element of the season. If, in fact, Brandon Belt looks like prime Brandon Belt, and obviously Vlad is playing 155, 160 games this season, and you got George Springer, who you really hope to get off his feet more often than not, how do you manage that playing time? And the easy answer and the obvious one is that these things take care of themselves because somebody's going to get hurt. And in regards to George Springer, that happens every single year, and especially like an aging player like Brandon Belt coming off an injury.
Brandon Belt and Kevin Kiermaier are both totally fine now.
They're fixed.
They are so ready to play a heavy workload because
you have
they
a lot of DHs on this
before.
Team.
They had a lot of injuries before, and they struggled with it earlier. But now they're older and had surgeries, and so it's fine.
It's totally fine. Well, and I didn't even mention Alejandro Kirk, who is – okay, we don't have a – there's no three-catcher system anymore. But, yeah, that's a guy who is obviously offensively gifted enough to get some – DH days when he's not catching, and in fact, you know, his best offense comes when he's not catching a whole bunch. So yeah, that's going to be an interesting element this season because maybe Brandon Belt doesn't start against lefty. Isn't that an overwhelming number of lefty starters? I mean, you go a week where you don't see one. So is Brandon Belt the everyday DH against righties? And how do you get Kirk's bat in the lineup? And like, how do you get George Springer off his feet?
I don't think
it's one of the more interesting
DH
elements this season.
I don't think Kirk is ever going to DH again.
I mean, that would be an extreme waste of what makes him most valuable. I know he's a great
pitch
framer
and
everything.
But here's the thing. Danny Jansen is also a guy that always gets hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you're putting Kirk into DH, like, yeah, there's too many guys like that have to be prioritized over him. Like, you need to make sure that you get those off days for Springer. You need to be able to make sure that Belt gets into your lineup. I shouldn't say never again, but I do feel like the frequency of him doing that is going to really, really crater. That it's not going to be like it was last year when they had three catching options and they could just kind of rip him in there from time to time.
Yeah, they have more options, which is good. Yeah. I mean, good teams are supposed to have, superfluous assets at multiple positions. And the Blue Jays have, great bench options potentially. Yeah. and they're spending almost $10 million on a guy who doesn't have a defined position and is just like a lefty, maybe pinch hitter off the bench and plays the position that your franchise player also plays and none other. So,
I told you, that's where the wall thing does come into effect. I feel like they got that information. They were like, this is what the wall is going to be. And then immediately they're like, Brandon Belt, we really want you on our team. And then he found out the dimension and he was like, I want $10 million. And they were like, deal. Like, this is actually worth it right now. Anyway, Benny, this was fun. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. I'm going to try to – I got machinations of trying to move Goodhour into a set spot soon. So hey, keep an eye out for that. Anyway, thanks for coming on, buddy. And thanks for the horrible advice about the
– All right. No problem.
Getting out of the conversations. Didn't really help me at all. And tell your wife to put some shoes on. Some socks at least. God, have some decency.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll tell her.
I hope she never
that's what you actually told me. Is because you know the next time I hang out and I have like 2 drinks, I'm going to be like, so! You know that I have
that
function.
I heard her walk through the hallway as I was doing this Good Hour segment with you. And I thought for a split second that she was going to burst in into this room here. Like, there's absolutely no way that this doesn't get back to her that I brought this to
good.
Light.
Like I said, I think that she needs an intervention on this. Anyway, buddy, I'll talk to you later. When we come back, quick break, and I'm going to talk to Nick Kyprios. What does Gary Bettman have to gain by telling everyone that tanking doesn't exist? I'm having a tough time putting a finger on it. That's next.
Nobody tanks because we have a weighted lottery, and you're not going to lose games to increase your odds by a couple of percentage points. That's silly. And frankly, suggesting tanking, I believe, is inconsistent with the professionalism that our players and our coaches have. Nobody tanks. Our players and our coaches do their best to win. And again, just because you may finish with the worst record in the league, you've got something like a 75% chance that you're not going to get the first pick.
This man. I used to do a segment called Today on Liars Who Lie, and you can't even use Liars Who Lie with Gary Bettman. This is something I don't know if Kipper's there yet, but this is going to be kind of the theme of this conversation is I don't understand what Gary Bettman has to gain sometimes by the hard line positions he takes on simple questions about trying to improve the game. And like, to be honest, I actually don't really have an issue with tanking. Would I love to live in some utopian sports world where there's a better system for getting the top players to different places? Sure. But we can't have it where it's free agency because teams would, like, the best players would continue to go to the best markets. And we have a hardline cap. And there's too many ways to screw that up. So what are you supposed to do? Like, football has it where you're the worst team just gets it. And you go from that point forward. The weighted lottery was supposed to encourage teams from... And I think that the weighted lottery has worked in this way. Like, if you're kind of a team in the middle, then you probably are more likely to try to win because you go, yeah, we can get playoff revenue and we can try to build through being competitive rather than, hey, let's tear this down and try to get a few percentage points extra. It's kind of like the position the Raptors are in, which is the worst, right? And I was talking to Ennis about this earlier. Like, the worst place you can be, I think right now in 2023 as a sports fan, is the good-bad team where you're too good to bottom out and get those top-end lottery odds. But you're too bad to do anything of consequence when the playoffs roll around if you can even make them. That was the worst I ever felt as a Leaf fan, was watching them finish 9th, missing the playoffs and going, oh, sweet. A middling draft pick and a year of being frustrated with a hockey team that was no good. But we've seen this before. Like, Bettman has his secret polls that tell you that everybody's so infatuated. Oh, God, do they love the digital ad boards? Oh, they make it easier for the casual hockey fan to watch. Sure, do they decapitate goaltenders if they're wearing the wrong colored sweater sometimes? Maybe. But the rest of the time, fans are losing their minds over it. Oh, the competitive balance of the league. Oh, it's never been better. The state of hockey, never been better. Nothing wrong, nothing to see here. But the tanking thing, like I mentioned, I don't mind it. I think that if you're a fan of a really bad team, you kind of accept your lot in life. It's only when you go year after year after year and you continuously kind of pick and you don't make any progress and it starts to get really frustrating and you miss out on that first overall pick or that second overall pick, those franchise-changing players, and you continuously accumulate like 4, 6, 8, you know, but you just suck and you don't ever get to watch a good product. That's awful. But the idea that organizations don't care about tanking, or that he tried to manipulate the truth, this is what a good liar does. A good liar goes, hey, the players aren't trying to tank. You're taking a shot at the credibility of the guys in the league. And you're like, what are you talking about? Yeah, no one really believes that players are putting the puck in their own net. No one thinks that coaches are designing game plans so that they lose. Although, yeah, you saw what the Coyotes have been doing lately with some of the goaltending choices. Anyway, they have like one good goalie and then one horrible goalie and then like playing one guy too many times, so that's kind of fishy. Either way, yeah, of course, owners. You don't think that these guys want to market Connor Bedard? You don't think that these owners care about this stuff? You're out of your mind. And so I don't understand why Bettman chose to take it this way and lie. Anyways, I hope Kipper's there. I haven't been told yet, but okay, he's still not there. He doesn't know how to connect? Call him on his phone. Anyway, I'm going to talk to Kipper about this. But, like, I sat with it yesterday. Like I said, I was on the train. I was coming back into the city. I saw the clip. And I listened to it. I kind of laughed. I had my moment where I just, you know, went over it and said, God, it's just, this guy's just too funny. But to me, I want to have a commissioner who is constantly open to the ideas of improving a league, and this isn't an area where I'm overly concerned about it, although it is going to be devastating, and maybe I will feel differently if Connor Bedard goes to the Ducks or to the Coyotes, but that's not really one of the issues. It's all like all the other stuff and wanting to improve the game and really trying to be creative about trying to take the next step for this league. But yeah, I just couldn't figure out why this lie. Like, what does he have to gain other than this image that he likes to perpetuate about hockey, that it's in a perfect state, that he's doing an incredible job? Like, has his job security ever been in question? It's not like he has to say that. Like, the owners know the score. I just don't get it. Nick Kiprios, Real Kipper and Born, finally connected. What's wrong with you? Why can't you get this thing going? Like, you do this every single day. What took you 7 minutes?
Well, listen, I'm a wily veteran. Not everybody needs a pregame warm-up for the whole 15, 18 minutes. Sometimes I like to come a little later and, you know, just take what I need and get ready for the big game, which is 3 to 5 on the Real Kipper and Bourne show.
That stung. Which you can also watch on YouTube, by the way, now, which is the way that I consume it. I love your guys' show. You guys have been crushing it lately. Okay, but Kipper, why did Bettman lie about the tanking thing? Bend the truth, however we want to put it, because the way he spun it was like players, how dare you say the players don't try, as if that's ever been the conversation about tanking. Why does this guy continuously put up the public-facing front of, hey, reasonable questions that fans have? You guys are idiots for ever thinking that the game isn't in a perfect place and that everything isn't humming along 100%. Like, why? What is the point of this lie specifically?
Well, like, you've been under a rock the last 10 months.
No, I know he's a liar.
They're betting on your game now. Why would you ever admit that teams would not step on the ice and to the best of their abilities, try to win that game? You've gone down a whole new path in terms of major revenue streams, which means that you have to believe that the intent and purpose of each and every game that you watch is for the sole purpose of trying to win that game. and that's his story, and he's sticking to it.
Yeah, except Kipper, this is the issue with that. The books don't believe him. And the books don't care. And we have, there's ways of correcting this, which is like, I saw yesterday, it was yesterday Bruins Habs? I was a little bit out of the loop, but I was looking at some scores. I'm looking at some betting lines. And yesterday, the Bruins were like -385 favorites against the Montreal Canadiens. And you go, yeah, they know. Like, they can already price this thing in. And again, no one is under the illusion or the disillusion that these players are not trying to win, or that these players don't have enough incentive to try and be their best versions of themselves. But once they hit the ice, the product is the product, the players are the players, and the tanking part of it is like what organizations do going in. Anyway, it goes even beyond this. Like I mentioned before you came on, how he talked about the digital ad boards, right, where he's got private surveys that tell him people are enamored by them. It's whether it's been the cap as an issue for this league, the competitive balance for this league, the playoff format for this league. Like, do you think that the game is in good hands right now when it's with somebody who just is very clearly just completely defiant about any of the changes that he's made to hockey and ever kind of making any adjustments with them?
JD, that's an excellent question, and I think there's always a couple of ways to look at things. And if you ask me to put together a presentation on, you know, where there's huge challenges for the league or sports in general, I can do that. If I can give you the same presentation on what's great about it and why it's in fantastic shape, I can do the same thing. I think we can do that in all industries and any shape of professional leagues, amateur leagues, minor hockey. We can do that. But overall, if I'm one of 32 owners, I'm very happy. I'm very happy watching the value of my franchise double or triple in the last little while. I'm excited about the gaming industry pumping millions upon millions of dollars into my league. And I'm watching perhaps a bidding war for the Ottawa Senators, where we all know is incredibly challenging there to sell tickets and corporate boxes and, to drive year after year a positive return. It's challenging, but there is a demand out there. Dallas Cowboys attracted 50 million viewers for their football game, which has to be absolutely ecstatic for the NFL. So, yeah, there's pros and cons on each side. But overall, again, if I'm an NHL owner, I think I'm very happy with what Gary Bettman and the league has been able to do.
Of course, as an owner.
And I'm guaranteed 50% of the revenue, no matter what. And I don't have to overpay for talent. It's all within, you know, a very tight run cost reassuring system. And I like that as an owner.
Yeah, of course, as an owner. This is why when fans go, why doesn't the NHL have a luxury tax? And I go, because the owners don't want it. That's why. The owners fought tooth and nail to make sure they cost themselves a season to make sure that it was a hard cap. They're never going to go backwards for this just because it would make the league better. What I'm saying is, like, I think that the best job you can do as a commissioner is when you balance those two things, right? When you do look at the long-term growth of the game and you make sure that, like, your product is sustainable and entertaining and fun and in the best place it can be, and not just purely everything we're going to side with ownership. I get it. I know that's the job. I don't have any illusions or any beliefs that a commissioner or like Bettman really cares about what hockey fan experiences it are or the best way to make the game competitive or what's going to grow it over the next 20 years that he's not going to be a part of. But shouldn't you? Like, that's what I mean. Of course, the owners are in a good spot. The franchise values go up. They have fixed costs. They're getting more money in. Their players don't have a ton of power. It's very easy to go from a team that is in the bottom to a playoff team. Like, you can do that lickety-split in this league. There's so much parity right now. But for long-term growth of the game, I do kind of worry that this the version of hockey that it is right now and its complete inability with Bettman to even make the slightest of adjustments to ensure a bit of a better product at the expense of potentially a little bit of money for the owners, like in the short term, that could benefit them in the long term, the lack of creativity for the product, it is concerning to me, man. Like, I don't love it.
Listen, no question, you bring up some valid points. And yes, the CBA is very frustrating. And it has taken maybe a good 15 years for a lot of fans to even understand it. And if you went to the majority of the fan base, I'm not even sure they would even know what escrow is, let alone describe it or how it affects their hockey club.
Despite us having a million escrow conversations since like 2005. 100%, it's like we've been hearing about 100%. It since 2005. But it's been almost 20 years, and you asked the common fan about it. They're like, I don't know. I don't want to know.
I know. But as time goes by, and if they start losing interest and finding out that there are no trades and there is no light at the end of the tunnel for their hockey club to get better, you know, their biggest voice is maybe not going or losing interest or spending their money elsewhere. And that's when I think Gary and the owners would revisit a lot of things that you have just described. But that's their greatest strength as a fan base is just starting to disengage. But I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think that it's a huge concern. Albeit, we'll see where a historic franchise like Chicago goes in the next few years. I mean, it was so healthy in the heyday of the Cups with Taves and Kane, Seabrook, Keith, Marc-Andre Fleury. But where are they headed? And where's that fan base? Are they going to be down to like 8,000-7,000 fans in the next 2 or 3 years and checked out? Mm-hmm. Then it starts to get noticed, and then a lot of things get revisited. But JD, we're not there yet.
I don't think we're there yet, but dude, it really does feel like we're on the precipice of this sometimes. And I feel it in this market, and I'm sure you have too. Like, Leaf fandom right now is in a place where you have McKee there every day, right? And he is your just dyed in the wool, cares so much, his mood gets swung by it, his relationships are connected to it, right? Like, it's why we love the kid. But also, what does he say to you all the time? Well, they're just locked into a spot with Tampa Bay, and it's going to be a coin toss series. And this is one of the most talented Leafs teams in the history of the franchise. This is the best they can possibly be, essentially, in a salary cap era where they've got youngish, I guess, stars in their prime who are really starting to take off, like a good balanced team. There's flaws, obviously. That's the way that it comes with a salary cap league. But like the fan engagement with the Leafs is kind of, there's like an apathy to it. And I'm very curious to see how this is going to play out here. If they lose to Tampa again and it comes down to a game seven, but they play really well and we all sort of acknowledge that it could have gone either way, but the playoff format is bad, and just how hockey fans in the biggest, most important market for the game are going to respond to something like that. And it doesn't feel like at all this commissioner cares about that apathy stuff, and it continues to be like the prioritization of these like small market places where we're saying, hey, they're not tanking, they're not doing the wrong things, hey, the revenue sharing is great, hey, the cap's good for them in case they ever want to get back in the mix. Kind of sucks. Speaking of the Leafs,
you haven't even mentioned the price point for them to go to a game or be involved in any way, shape, or form outside of just watching the games on television.
Yep.
And I will say this: as fat and as rich as you think MLSE is at the top, what you're saying is not lost on them, and they do understand at that office that the next few years, you're not sure where that supply and demand will be. Is it just a given year after year that people will want to get in the building at all costs continue to drive the machine? I don't think it's a given as it was years ago moving forward here. It is a very expensive entertainment industry right now out there, which only a fraction of the community can afford to participate in. And if you're talking about that apathy settling in, then it can be challenging moving forward. Tickets are very, very expensive, and that's not lost on the community.
So I think that the Leafs will always be, or at least for the future, they're going to continue to be fine, because we live in a big time status reality where everyone wants to show off status, and going to a Leafs game and being able to post that on your social media still has this incredible status value. Even if you don't think the entertainment product is great, people will always want to do that. This is an event city where people want to be at events, and the Leafs always just feels like that.
It could be uncool to be there if they're not challenging, if they're not competing.
For sure. And maybe that's why the weirdo in me, as you said that, went, maybe the best thing for hockey, maybe the best thing for the game is going to be the Leafs get knocked out again and some heavyweights like MLSE, like real money, real power in the league, starting to go, you know what? We're over this. Like, we're over this format. We're over this setup. We're over, all of these different things. We want our team to have a better shot, and we should have a better shot than Arizona. And maybe they move some weight. What do you think about that theory?
You know, the rest of the league's listening. You're going, oh, you sour grapes. Just play Tampa.
I don't care about them. They're irrelevant. They're irrelevant. This is Toronto. This is the straw that stirs the drink, baby. This is where 40% of the population of Canada is, like, in this province, and they all cheer for one team. Like, no, I don't care. I don't care about the rest of them.
All right.
Yeah. You're not with me? You don't think that MLC?
I'm a hockey guy. Just find a way to beat Tampa Bay. Find a way to get through the first round and make people feel real good around here.
That hurt me, suggesting that I'm not a hockey guy. I don't get to go to the goalies with you today. We went too long with that. All right, Kipper. I'll talk to you later, buddy. Thanks for coming on.
JD, always a pleasure, pal.
Listen to you later today. Again, 3 to 5, Real Kipper and Bourne. Can watch it on YouTube, which I really, again, enjoy. It's fun being able to see the fellas. It's fun being able to see Bourne's face as Kipper and Sammy gear up a hot take, a spicy one for him. Yeah, it's fun watching Kipper's face when he dangles something out there for them. He's trying to get them to take the bait. Anyway, I'm trying to get you to take the bait right now on a prop, because it's time for action. Brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in the action. Must be 19 plus, must be in Ontario. Please play responsibly. Okay, so lost in the Eagles win. AJ Brown hobbling around the field. AJ Brown, they aired one out late in the football game. He goes after some 9 route into the end zone. They miss him as the Eagles were just continuously trying to embarrass the Giants. And he's looking like he's pulling up lame. And Nick Sirianni is saying, hey, he's going to play, he's going to play, he's going to play, it's fine. But in that game against the Giants, and granted, he's nicked up, and they don't want to push him too hard, but he only played 73% of the snaps on offense, and he was only targeted 6 times. He caught 3 passes for 22 yards. And that was against a defense that had basically been broken on the first drive of the game. And do I think that, like, A.J. Brown is going to tough this out and step out onto the field and do all these things? Yes, absolutely. Of course he's going to. He's a gamer. He'll be all right. He's actually got a history of decent success against the Niners, although I don't think that matters because this year's Niners defense is much better. But I go to A.J. Brown's props. I'm like, I'm not touching his touchdown. Like, he might get that. That's actually a spot where you go, yeah, we need A.J. Brown to, like, we're 3rd and 7. We're throwing the fade to A.J. Brown. We're throwing the jump ball to A.J. Brown still. You got one in you, A.J.? Yeah, doing it. But I'm going under. A.J. Brown, 70.5 yards on DraftKings right now. I really think that he went 22 last week against the Giants. Again, game script, all kinds of different factors into this. That he's going to jump up over 70 this week against a better Niners defense when he's not 100%. And when he played that little of a snap count, and his coach is saying, like, he is going to play, don't worry about it. I don't know. I just don't feel great about it. And maybe the case for the Niners, or maybe the case for him being better, is that he, you know, like, the Niners factor this in and they see what he's got. But either way, A.J. Brown, under. That's my prop on a Wednesday. We'll get into the lines later this week and we'll hit some of our best bets. But that's my prop today. That was Time for Action, brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in the action. Must be 19 plus, must be in Ontario. Please play responsibly. Quick break. Then my friend, one of my favorites, Dan Hanzus, the Around the NFL podcast. That's next.
Sportsnet 590.
I'm going to just weigh in on the OG stuff. Because, yeah, for those of you that don't know, some rumors flew around yesterday. A bunch of them, actually, because, yeah, it was Kevin O'Connor who brought up the Fred VanVleet stuff and how the Clippers might be targeting him. And that the Suns might actually be interested. Mark Stein had one where it's the Suns interested in Fred. Actually, I'll just start with Fred because I'm already off topic. The VanVleet thing is going to be super interesting because his contract is tough to trade. It's an in-season move, which is the whole, like, most of the reason why at least a couple of these teams would be trading for him is to get a guard that has some playoff experience and who can actually provide something for them now. If it's a sign-and-trade the Lowry way, which is also possible with Fred, I just think that this is like, this is the recreation of the Lowry deal entirely, where Masai Ujiri is going to be very patient with Fred VanVleet. He's not going to rush to a move. He does not care that he's in an expiring contract. He will take his time. He's got to believe that come end of season, that when Fred is up for a new deal and they're going to negotiate, like, he's going to have a really good handle on where this is going. But he and Bobby Webster, when he knows and they know what Fred VanVleet wants conclusively, now he fired his agent, by the way, might be negotiating for himself, which is always a little tricky. Because it can get prickly real fast. Can get prickly real fast when a guy is negotiating for himself. Saw the way that it went down again with my Seattle Seahawks and Bobby Wagner. One of the franchise's best players, beloved player, guy who was in like incredible in the community, all these different things, and negotiated for himself, business went poorly, and now hates Seattle and wants nothing to do with him. Villains in his eyes. So a little bit of scaries with Fred VanVleet in that regard. You'd always love that there's at least that agent buffer. But I don't think they're going to be pressed into any type of contract with Fred. And they're certainly not going to be pressed into any kind of deal. And that's why I think the Clippers one is kind of unrealistic, to be honest, because I don't think that the Clippers have enough to give the Raptors that Masai isn't going to say, yeah, you know what, we'll wait. We'll see what Orlando says come the offseason. We'll see what Phoenix says come the offseason. Two places that will absolutely be looking to invest in Fred VanVleet and his services as a potential free agent. So you can do some kind of sign and trade the way that you did with Lowry. Bueno. Perfecto. That's what you're going to be looking for. And I still believe, like, if you ask me, hey, JD, what's the odds of Fred getting dealt at the deadline? I'd say pretty low. I think that that's the way this is going to go. That either he re-signs with the Raps on a friendly-ish deal, right? Because you can't give Fred more money than he was offered a year ago. Like, I don't even know how you spin that one. I have no clue how you make that a palatable sell job to the fan base. I think Fred is good. I think that the Raptors could end up pivoting and they could end up still being competitive next season. And that there's reason to believe with Scottie Barnes' improvement that they could take a step next year that, whatever, that this was just a bad season. They add the draft pick. They add another mid-level exception player to the rotation. Who knows? Like, there's a case. I don't think it's as strong of a case as the one that I've basically advocated for, I don't know, months and months. But there is a case. You can bring Fred back, but he has to take a little bit of a haircut on the deal. He wants to stay a Raptor. He stays part of the leadership structure. They tell him they're still trying to win. Blah, 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 blah. But if they get a Godfather deal, I think they move him at the deadline. I just don't see the Godfather deal happening because, one, his play has been inconsistent. He does have that player option in case there is an injury for a guy who has gotten injury prone. And I just don't think that his like price point is to the place where a team is going to offer something that over the top. You know me. I spend so much time on the NBA trade machine. I love it. I love the NBA trade machine. Can't remember a single trade that made sense. Outside of kind of Dallas, I made a trade that I thought was okay if the Raptors were willing to take back some bad money, which I always advocate for, and if the Mavericks were willing to put two firsts into the deal. Problem is they don't have their first this year. And if you're the Raptors, I think you kind of need that because this draft is just as many bullets as you can draft. But outside of that, like, there's no spot. The Sixers, no. Like, well, basically, I can just tell you immediately that there's no landing spot in the Eastern Conference for Fred VanVleet that I see, unless it is the Magic getting ahead of themselves with the business they're conducting. I don't see it with the Knicks. That's the only place that you could kind of squint and go, maybe. I've tried to do trades with them and Gary Trent. But again, I don't know what the Knicks would be willing to part with. They've got some pretty solid young players that I don't think are enough for the Raptors to go, this guy's awesome, we need that guy. And then also from the Knicks standpoint, they're probably looking at it going, like, does Fred VanVleet really put us over the top where we're going to, like, give up a first or a young controllable player and have a backcourt that's undersized of VanVleet and Brunson? Kind of similar guys. I don't know. It doesn't reek of a fit for me. The spots are the West. Out West is it, where you look at it and go, okay, there's a variety of different teams that would obviously want to load up and try to get better. But from a salary matching standpoint and an asset standpoint, I don't see it. I don't feel a fit. Even with the Phoenix Suns, right? Because they're the number one team. Because like Orlando could get the business done in the offseason. Phoenix, of course, would love to be able to bring in Fred for another run and have another guard. And yeah, dual point guard. He can always play off the ball. He'd be great with Chris Paul. There's no question about it. There's no salary that can come back the other way. Like it's incredibly hard deal to make. Because Jay Crowder doesn't make enough money, and he's the sort of dead cash. They're not trading Ayton. They need him. Like, you're not beating the Denver Nuggets this year without a center, and yeah, you're not going into Dario Saric range. And so I'm just, the Suns are kind of the lurking team where maybe, just maybe, they can get a third team involved and they can push for Fred. But the Clippers, to me, they just don't have the assets. The Mavericks, I think, are the best fit, but I have a really, really hard time seeing how the Fred deal gets done now. To me, it goes into the offseason, and the Raptors either bring him back or they sign and trade him. They're not going to lose him for nothing. It's not going to happen. So don't fret if VanVleet doesn't get moved at the deadline. Trent, that's the interesting one that's the doomsday one where if he doesn't get traded, you're getting nothing or you're overpaying him. And I think that would be a disaster. And again, I respect Granger's reporting and I believe him because I know that Masai Ujiri is the type of guy. And Ennis and I talked about this earlier in the show, just about how, boy, that is the tough thing about some of these smart front offices, is maybe they don't take a step back to take a step forward. I think he will get it done. I think that there's the same urgency as there was with Norm Powell. It's literally the exact same thing. They kicked the can down the road for two seasons and they ended up in the exact same spot they were at with Norm, which is a guard that can score differently. Norm more of a rim attacking player, Trent more of a perimeter player. They got a shooting guard who can score, who is coming off of a career season. They don't want to pay him all the money. He doesn't play defense, even though Trent gets tips and steals and all these different things. But they don't want to pay him. And they certainly don't want to pay him whatever he wants. He'll get traded. OG is the fascination point. Siakam's not getting dealt at the deadline. I put together a fake trade for Blake Murphy that involves one that I think is just kind of fun. It's a three-teamer. But it's just a one for giggles, and it's more of a thought exercise than anything that I think is a reality. OG, according to the Bob McCallum podcast, quote, this is Bob. I talked to an insider inside the NBA yesterday. It's very deep inside. It's the insider that's inside the NBA. On the phone, just by accident, he called me. He's a guy I've known for several years. He tells me that Ananobi wants out of Toronto, end quote. This is accompanied by Bruce Arthur of the Toronto Star saying that a team has offered or had offered three first-round picks for OG. This is really where the Raptors have to make just an incredibly difficult decision, and I think it's one of the more interesting ones around the NBA. Is if they trade OG Anunoby, it's pretty clear that they're going to take a step back, and it's going to really determine the direction of the franchise. I just don't know how they turn that around. And I wonder how much politicking is going to go on with the team, but boy, three first-round picks for OG Anunoby, like... And granted, the NBA, you can't trade back-to-backs, right? And so if you're thinking, hey, this is a way of building around Scottie Barnes where you get one this year, one next year, you can't do that. So three first-round picks doesn't sound as appealing. Like, it's not as easy to do. But from the right franchise, could make a lot of sense. Like, that is the one upside of that Clippers pick if they decided to do that with the Fred VanVleet trade. If that did happen, I'd immediately be talking myself into the idea of, like, okay, well, the Clippers are a historically horrific franchise, and let's say they even do re-sign Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, whatever, because they don't really have any other options. What are those going to look like in 2026, 2028, whenever that next pick that they convey is? That might be a real lottery ticket, and sometimes in the NBA, those are the best assets that you can get is – bad organization. Again, the Raptors actually end up making the Kawhi trade because they grab the 9th overall pick from the Knicks for Bargnani. They get a future pick from a bad franchise, trying to do a little too much. It doesn't end up the asset Toronto thinks it's going to be in the moment, but Poeltl gets ended up traded in the Kawhi trade. Top 10 picks have value for quite some time. Even another organization might see more value. But OG, three first-round picks. The question is, if he wants out of Toronto, and this is a real report, like, you know, if this is a real thing, if the cone of silence has been shattered, there'd always been a little bit of buzz about how OG was in his role, but I could see that for him from this season. Like, Fred wasn't happy with his role, and he's talked about it publicly. Siakam wants to be the man. That's very, very clear. They have a head coach that butts heads with his guys from time to time. OG's got a big contract coming up. There are games where he can really, you know, he gets hot, he scores. And every team needs like that 3-and-D wing, which is kind of a weird thing for OG where it's like, okay, he wants out of Toronto. Well, what? Is it a role situation if he's upset? Because his role is going to be pretty similar wherever he goes. In fact, it might even be to a degree diminished from an offensive standpoint because the idea would be that he'd be going to a better team. Maybe not with as many mouths to feed, so who knows, right? Like if he went to Dallas, for example, he'd probably end up having more because he'd be the number two next to Luka. He'd be empowered. But he ends up in a different spot, and, you know, maybe he is just more of he's a catch-and-shoot player with the odd dribble drive. Toronto, he's pretty much, like, got green light and free reign to do what he wants offensively in a lot of situations. So, yeah, I'm not... The reason why he wants out is interesting. That's the key here. Is it role... or is it something deeper? If this is true. Because if it's something deeper, one, you need to keep it in-house. But two, you absolutely need to trade OG this offseason. Roles you can change. That you can always adjust with a player. And usually money fixes those things. And it'll be all right. But deeper, he doesn't want to be in the city if that is the case. He wants to be somewhere else. He wants to be playing for a contender. You got to bottle this up and you got to get ahead of it while there's still three first-round picks out there. The only thing I would say to that, though, even as I'm kind of like arguing against myself, is there will still be enough suitors for OG Anunoby where I would imagine that you would still be able to get one hell of a haul. I used to be very, very adamantly against trading OG Anunoby. Been on the record with that for a very long time. Even with the injury stuff that's happened in his career, I still think from a timeline standpoint and a fit standpoint, he's the best guy to pair with Scottie Barnes. The idea is that you're really not trying to win in this era of the Raptors, which I think is very clear. I don't think that they're going to win another championship with this current iteration of players or like as their core. I don't think that the tweaks around it are going to be able to be good enough. I don't see it. There's just no way forward for me. So you got to make the decisions. And OG always made sense as a guy. Well, you could build around an OG Scottie Barnes foundation and potentially even move off of Siakam, move off of Fred, move off of Gary Trent. Precious Achiuwa is kind of one of your nice blue chip guys that you want to build around too. Great. But you have to sell high